coming up from the My Ag Life Daily News Report for this Friday. We report on the State Assembly Water, Parks, and Wildlife Committee meeting, and we'll have today's news brief. But we start with a check-in on grapes. I'm your host, Sabrina Halverson. Joining me on the phone is Stephen Vasquez, technical viticulturist for SunMate. Here's our conversation.
All right. So, Stephen, I just wanted to chat with you and see how grapes are looking so far this spring. How are things going out there?
Well, currently we've got nearly 100% bud break. So as you drive around the valley, you'll see most vineyards are definitely out. There's a lot of green leaf tissue that is pushed out, and so the grapes are growing. We've got a little cool down right now, so they're going to slow down a little bit. But that's going to give guys a chance to get out there with their spray rigs and get that soft green tissue protected against powdery mildew.
So what is it that growers should be looking for? Or are there specific things that we should be concerned about right now?
Yeah, I think with early season, so in 2019, we had a really bad mildew year. And I think part of that was grapes pushing out and getting some really warm weather and things just taking off and growers getting behind. So in 2020, growers took note of that, and they did a very good job of managing powdery mildew. I think that's still at the forefront of their mind, and so there's a lot of spray rigs that are out right now protecting, applying fungicides to protect that young succulent tissue so we don't have a repeat of 2019 and the bad mildew that we saw then.
What kind of conditions lead to having a heavier year for the powdery mildew?
So definitely warm weather, really, you know, in the unusually warm weather during this time. So when we get into the 80s, mid-80s, and start pushing into the 90s, you can get very fast growth, and as those vines grow, you really have to make sure that they're protected. And so a grower may have to make multiple passes in a short period of time to get all that green tissue, the new green tissue, protected. And so we had some warm weather, and then I think for the next 3 or 4 days, we're back down into the 70s during the day. And so this is giving growers a chance to get their rigs out and cover, you know, the ground that they need to cover, you know, based on the number of acres that they have, and protect that green tissue so it doesn't get infected with powdery mildew. Powdery mildew is probably the number one disease that growers deal with, and it can have significant impacts on the health of the vine and the overall yield and quality of the fruit by the end of the year. And so growers really need to remain vigilant about powdery mildew and making sure that they get fungicides on at the right time.
Whenever we talk about, you know, conditions, obviously in California, we always end up at some point thinking about water. And we've had, again, more disappointing news this year for water and drought. What are growers facing with that, and how will that have an effect on the crop this year?
So I've spent some the last probably 3, 4, 5 days talking with growers about soil moisture and making sure that there's enough moisture in the ground as these vines are pushing and producing some new growth. So they just need to make sure that they've, you know, got a soil probe and are probing down and making sure that soil is moist enough for the vine to pick up moisture. And then, you know, a lot of growers, some of the larger growers do have weather networks. And so they're monitoring those soil moisture probes online and just kind of IDing those fields that may have light soils, some sandy soils where the water just is not held for a really long time. And so if growers are on those types of soils, they need to really manage and monitor that water and make sure that it's available to the vines during this critical time. This is a critical growth period, and so you need to make sure that there's enough soil moisture in the ground.
So Taylor, my coworker Taylor, got to talk with you about weather monitoring systems, I believe. Can we talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so, depending on the size of a grower, weather stations are a really good investment. You know, they really kind of take the guesswork out of trying to understand soil moisture, weather. There's a lot of disease models or insect models that can be used with weather stations, and that really gives the grower an edge in terms of timing pesticides, whether it's fungicides for powdery mildew or insecticides for some of the insect pests that grape growers deal with. I think they're a really good investment, but they do take some time to learn how to use. And if the grower themselves is not going to be the primary user, then they need to make sure that they have a person that has spent some time with the manufacturer learning the hardware and software and understanding how to generate reports that can then be used or shared with the grower or any other colleagues that need that information. For example, if you're looking at soil moisture and you're trying to develop an irrigation schedule, it's important to make sure that the report is a format that the person that's in charge of turning the water on and off can understand that report and knows what the report is saying, or the person that's in charge needs to help educate them and allow them to use that as a resource, as a tool, which is what it really is. And they've been around for a long time. They've gotten a lot better with apps and the ability to look at the data on your phone has become much easier and much more useful. So great tools, but it does take some time investment to learn how to use them properly.
Right. And if you're not using it properly, then the investments, you're not getting a whole lot out of the investment, I'm sure.
Yeah, the biggest challenge initially when growers decide to put a weather station or a network in their vineyard or orchard is the initial understanding of and use of generating those reports. And there are some manufacturers that have easier reports, and it all depends on what the grower is after. I mean, there are very sophisticated weather stations that are used for research, but, there are some growers that like to use those because of the information that you can generate. And then there are very easy to use weather stations where the app just basically spits out the information into a graph for you and, helps you outline what your plan of action is going to be based on the graph that's generated, and they're both good tools. It's just a matter of the investment that the grower or the grower's employees want or need to put in order to understand those and make them useful.
All right. Bottom line, as we're midway or getting into April, what's your feeling now? At this point in the spring for this year's grape crop?
I think, it's still too early to tell. I know a lot of growers will start next week. They'll start doing their bunch counts as the shoots grow a little bit more. So there are some vineyards where they're still too small to really identify the clusters. So next week, I think, a lot of growers and a lot of organizations will be out counting bunches and kind of getting an idea of where the 2021 season is going to take us. We're hopeful that it's going to be bigger than last year. Last year, Raisin Table wine grapes were down in yield. Some vineyards hit harder than others. I mean, there were vineyards that were 50% loss, and there were vineyards that maybe were just down by 10%. So, but a 50% loss for a grower, I mean, that's pretty substantial, you know, if they're a raisin table or wine grape grower. And so we'll have a better idea to see where we're at. 2020 was a short year in terms of overall yield statewide.
Thank you again to Stephen Vasquez, technical viticulturist for SunMade. Our news brief is up next. We'll be right back.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board. Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Here's your news brief for today. 24 environmental and consumer groups are asking the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate large dairy and hog farms under the federal air pollution laws. Groups like the Sierra Club and the Government Accountability Project are claiming that the EPA has the duty and authority to regulate these, quote, methane super emitters under the Clean Air Act as part of the administration's larger strategy to prevent catastrophic and irreversible climate change. The petition calls for regulations on operations with at least 500 cows or 1,000 hogs in place without access to pasture. Agricultural innovations have increased significantly in recent decades, and that pace is expected to be even faster in the future. Here's Rod Bain.
The pace of developing new innovations in agriculture, as well as building upon existing ones, will continue to accelerate going forward. That's according to ag tech analyst and consultant Chad Colby.
Whatever you think might be coming, historically it gets here twice as fast as you think, and it's better than you ever thought it would be when it gets here.
Case in point, it has been just in recent years that combines, tractors, and other farm equipment contained innovations such as auto steering and connectivity to execute precision agriculture. And into the now and the future.
We've got equipment today for the first time where equipment has the ability to make decisions. You're harvesting corn, for example. In the past, you would make settings to that combine, and those settings were only as good as the operator. If you're not familiar with a harvesting application, there's a lot of things that affect that. In the last 5 years, there's actually automation in combines for it to automatically adjust through the fields.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
70 of the top agriculture, conservation, and wildlife groups delivered a letter to Congress last week asking for robust funding for conservation programs and technical assistance for the fiscal year 2022. In the letter, groups like the American Farmland Trust, the National Association of Conservation Districts, and many others called on House and Senate appropriators to provide necessary robust increases to discretionary USDA conservation funding and reject any cuts to Farm Bill conservation programs through the fiscal year 2022 appropriations process. Chinese purchases of U.S. agricultural products are still setting records. Here's Gary Crawford with more.
The latest official numbers for Chinese purchases of U.S. ag products are for the first 5 months of this fiscal year, October through February.
China's purchases were $20.2 billion, up 182% from that same period in 2020.
USDA economist Bart Kenner says China's buying more of practically every major U.S. crop. So, for example, in dollar terms for the first 5 months of the fiscal year,
soybeans were $13.2 billion, up 225% from the $4 billion in 2020. Corn is $1.2 billion, up a ridiculously large percent. 425,362%.
Wow, Chinese purchases of U.S. animal products are up as well, up 36%, with big gains for U.S. beef, poultry, and dairy products. Pork sales, though, down 30%. China continues to rebuild its swine herd. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
New data from the Plant-Based Foods Association and the Good Food Institute show U.S. retail sales of plant-based foods continued double-digit increases in 2020, rising 27%. That brought the total plant-based market value to $7 billion. The plant-based food market grew almost twice as fast as the total U.S. retail food market, which increased 15% as COVID-19 closed restaurants and consumers stocked up at the grocery store. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack pledged to root out discrimination at USDA in testimony to a House Agriculture Committee hearing on the state of the nation's black farmers. Stephanie Ho has the story.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack provided testimony recently at an historic House Agriculture Committee hearing
on the state of black farmers in America and discrimination directed at black farmers by the Department of Agriculture.
He made a very public pledge to the committee.
From me and from the team at USDA, that we will, over the next 4 years, do everything we can to root out whatever systemic racism and barriers may exist at the Department of Agriculture directed at black farmers, socially disadvantaged farmers.
And he added,
work has begun already to start with the implementation of President Biden's executive order on equity. A working group has been formed at USDA across all agencies, and they've already begun to meet and to begin the work of the assessment of services, benefits, contracts, and procurements, and barriers and problems that may exist.
I'm Stephanie Ho, and in this week's Agriculture USA, we'll dig into the topic of the hearing, the state of the nation's black farmers.
For decades, the discrimination against black farmers by the United States Department of Agriculture has been well documented.
That was House Agriculture Committee Chairman David Scott.
Reports by the United States Commission on Civil Rights, the Government Accountability Office, and even the United States Department of Agriculture itself describes the discriminatory practices that were enabled by laws dating back all the way to the 1930s. That's why I'm saying this is historic.
Ranking Committee Member Glenn Thompson also addressed the more than 4.5-hour-long hearing.
Everyone participating today is familiar with the 1999 class action suit, Pickford versus Glickman, a case that alleged decades of discrimination by the U.S. Department of Agriculture against black farmers applying for farm loans and other government assistance.
In his testimony, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack said the American Rescue Plan contains steps that allow USDA to address the cumulative effects of past discrimination.
By providing debt relief for socially disadvantaged producers, by establishing an equity commission to review barriers that exist at USDA, to assist with heirs' property issues, expanded outreach, market development, and land access.
He said there are two types of loans that USDA is planning to forgive for black and socially disadvantaged farmers, direct and guaranteed loans. He said direct loans will be handled as quickly as possible.
120%, basically, the loan gets paid off, 20% goes to the farmer for the purpose of paying the tax.
This addresses one concern raised by Congressman Scott from previous settlements.
Black farmers were saddled with IRS tax bills from that Pickford settlement, leaving many of them worse off.
Meanwhile, for guaranteed loans, Secretary Vilsack said some farmers may want to spread out the debt forgiveness over more than 1 year for tax reasons.
Remember, we're dealing with banks where we have essentially guaranteed the loan. And we have sent a letter today to those banks basically indicating that they are to take no further action whatsoever to foreclose on farmers, that we are going to work with them to get these loans paid off.
Besides debt forgiveness, he added that other efforts include expanding market opportunities and looking at ways to work with other federal agencies to secure access to more land for farming.
I'm thinking of the Department of Defense, for example. They have a lot of land that surrounds a lot of the military installations. A lot of that land is in rural communities. A lot of that land is farmable. And who do they have farming that land? Can that be something that could potentially be made available to minority and socially disadvantaged and beginning farmers?
Meanwhile, he pointed to the disbursement of funds so far under the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program, or CFAP, as an example of inequity.
If you take a look at the payments that have been made to those who have self-identified as white, black, and other socially disadvantaged categories, In CFAP 1 and CFAP 2, black farmers would have received approximately $20 to $21 million. White farmers, white men and women farmers, would have received $5.6 billion.
In other words, only about 1% of the CFAP relief payments went to socially disadvantaged producers.
We're going to do additional outreach on CFAP 2 to make sure that those socially disadvantaged producers that have not yet applied for the ability to participate in that program are given a 60-day opportunity to do so. And the hope is, with additional outreach, that we'll see more applications from socially disadvantaged producers.
Sign up for CFAP 2 was reopened on April 5th for 60 days.
I plan to have in place a system of rigorous reporting, accountability, and oversight in all of our equity efforts. Let me be clear, there is no place at the USDA for discrimination.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's your news brief for today. Coming up next, the State Assembly Water, Parks, and Wildlife Committee meeting. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? ProMax is your number one solution. ProMax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. ProMax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRite Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/ProMax for more information.
My Ag Life, calendar of events. Here's Taylor Chalstrom with what's happening around the state.
On April 13th, we have IPM for spotted lanternfly. On April 14th, we have vertebrate pest and early season grape IPM. And on April 15th, we have navigating the UC IPM website and NorCal Climate Futures, forest health and fire preparedness. Check them out at myaglife.com. And registration is now open for the 2021 Almond Day, which will be on June 15th, hosted by West Coast Nut. It'll be a virtual event with CEU credits offered.
Get more details at myaglife.com.
State Assembly Water, Parks, and Wildlife Committee heard Bill 1500 at their meeting Thursday. AB 1500 would enact the Safe Drinking Water, Wildfire Prevention, Drought Preparation, Flood Protection, Extreme Heat Mitigation, and Workforce Development Bond Act of 2022, which, approved by the voters, would authorize the issuance of bonds for projects relating to those matters. The bill had wide support during the meeting. Here are some of the comments presented to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members, and Assemblymember Mullen. On behalf of the largest employers in the San Francisco Bay Area, the Bay Area Council is pleased to support AB 1500 and respectfully requests your aye vote. Within the past 7 years, California's already volatile climate has shattered longstanding climate records related to drought, wildfire, heat, and flood events. These disasters damage ecosystems, they hurt communities, and disrupt and too often cost lives. The 2012 to 2016 drought, for example, cost $3.8 billion in economic losses and nearly 30,000 jobs. The 2018 wildfires alone cost almost $150 billion in losses and killed 103 Californians. The 2017 floods cost $73 million in losses in San Jose alone and nearly toppled the Oroville Dam emergency spillway. And August 2020 was the hottest month in state history. Extreme heat is causing increased numbers of public safety power shutoff events, rolling blackouts, and averaging about 40 deaths each year, as indicated by the previous speaker. AB 1500 would invest $6.7 billion in upgrading and improving the resilience of California's neighborhoods, businesses, infrastructure, and ecosystems to these and other climate-related challenges. And in doing so, AB 1500 would not only help save lives and avoid costly damages from climate-related disasters, but would also help create jobs, stimulate growth, improve ecosystem health, and protect communities. According to analysis conducted by the Bay Area Council earlier last year, a bond measure of similar size and structure as AB 1500 would create between 75,000 and 120,000 jobs and generate between $9.6 billion and $15 billion in total economic activity across California. Putting people to work to strengthen their natural environment is an American tradition going back to the New Deal, and the most recent polling shows a strong majority of Californians would support a climate resilience bond that ties to job growth like this one does. Thank you for taking my comments, and I respectfully ask for your I vote.
Moderator, can you open the lines for support?
Good afternoon, members. Alma Barrera with the Weideman Group on behalf of Bloom Energy and support.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. Jamie Goh on behalf of ASUL, Environmental Defense Fund, CalTrout, Trout Unlimited, and Parks Now in support. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Jamie Miner on behalf of Eastern Municipal Water District, Santa Margarita Water District, Turlock Irrigation District, and MCE. We are in support if amended and really appreciate the measure moving forward.
Hey, Juan Altamirano with Audubon California in support.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Ross Buckley on behalf of the City of Sacramento in support of the measure. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Melissa Romero with the California League of Conservation Voters offering support and concept for the bill. Urge the legislature to pass a climate bond this year. Thank you.
Good afternoon. This is Justin Heyer with the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. We thank the authors for bringing forward this very important measure, and we have a support if amended position for the reasons outlined in our letter. Thank you so much.
Hi, Audrey Ratajczyk from Cruise Strategies on behalf of Sacramento County in support. Thank you.
Hi, Natalie Vergara on behalf of the California State Parks Foundation, California Habitat Conservation Planning Coalition, and California Association of Local Conservation Corps, all in support if amended as described in their submitted letters. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. Stephen Myers on behalf of Community Nature Connection, Mid-Peninsula Regional Open Space District, and Save the Redwoods League, all in support of amended as described in their submitted letters. Thank you.
Good afternoon again. This is Jennifer Fearing, and the California Association of Museums has a supportive amended position if the bond were to include funding for projects to protect California's cultural and historical resources from climate impact. We look forward to working with the author. Thank you.
Danielle Blassett-Hyden with California Municipal Utilities Association. We have a support and amend position as outlined in our letter. Thanks so much.
Yeah, this is Mark Henley with California Waterfowl Association. We have a support with amendments position. We would like to see an inclusion of funding for Department of Fish and Wildlife waterfowl habitat programs. We appreciate the consideration. Thank you.
The bill would provide for the changes to ultimately be decided by voters on the November 8, 2022 statewide general election. At Thursday's meeting, committee members discussed AB 614, the bill pertaining to wildlife habitat for birds. In addition to raising some fees for bird hunting, it makes minor changes to the eligibility for the California Winter Rice Habitat Incentive Program. The California Rice Commission supports the bill. The bill is by Assemblymember Cecilia Aguiar-Curie, who presented the bill to the committee.
State duck and upland game bird stamps required to hunt waterfowl and upland game birds. AB 614 also requires greater accountability and improved transparency over the spending of the funds collected via the upland game bird stamp in line with current practices for the state duck stamp. Lack of available nesting cover, especially in agricultural areas like the Sacramento Valley rice growing region, is a significant limiting factor for breeding waterfowl and other ground nesting birds. The nesting bird program is flexible enough to meet California growers' needs, as funds can be used to plant cover crops, enhance existing nesting bird habitat, or establish nesting cover on the lands that are fallowed under different programs. AB 614 is a resource-generating conservation measure that will complement our statewide goals for carbon sequestration, improving air quality, and protection of our waterfowl species. This bill has received no opposition and enjoys widespread support from a diverse coalition of sportsmen's groups, conservation organizations, and private landowners and agricultural representatives. With me to testify today in support is Mark Henley with the California Waterfowl Association and Louis Brown on behalf of the California Rice Commission.
Please, your first witness, proceed.
As you are aware, AB 614 is very similar to AB 2106 that passed the committee last year. The Nesting Bird Habitat Incentive Program is an existing program in the Fifth Fish and Game Code, but it lacks funding. AB 614 would provide a $5 surcharge on both state duck and upland game bird stamps, which our members must purchase to hunt game birds to help start up the program. There's a pressing need for the implementation of this program. Lack of sufficient vegetative cover is a significant limiting factor for breeding waterfowl and other grassland nesting birds, as identified in bird habitat plans signed by the state of California. Studies have also demonstrated that providing additional nesting cover through the breeding season can greatly benefit local waterfowl and other birds. For example, the results of a 2013 rice cover crop rotation pilot project found that annual cover crops located adjacent to rice cultivation produced especially high nest success. That was about 39%. Our local waterfowl populations have declined 36% statewide since 1992, which is very disheartening. It should also be noted that there was a die-off of over 60,000 waterfowl at the Klamath refuges in 2020. Due to a disease outbreak. Many of the birds affected were waterfowl that breed in the Central Valley but use the Klamath refuges for molting purposes, which puts further stress on their populations. The Nesting Bird Habitat Incentive Program is designed to be flexible for California growers. It would permit farmers to rotate their fallow fields each year. It would also incentivize wheat farmers to delay harvest of their crop, give nesting waterfowl and other birds enough time to successfully hatch their eggs. The program builds on the highly successful non-regulatory approach of other waterfowl bird conservation initiatives that provide financial incentives and work cooperatively with private landowners. In addition to helping birds and other wildlife, the program would sequester carbon, improve soil health, and provide air quality benefits, which was mentioned. For these reasons, we respectfully ask you to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next witness, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Louis Brown calling today on behalf of the California Rice Commission. For all the reasons previously stated in regards to the Nesting Bird Habitat Program, we're in support of the bill. We're also in support for the changes that the bill provides for the California Winter Rice Habitat Incentive Program, which incentivizes growers in the rice industry to flood their fields in wintertime so that these important wetlands could be made available for the Pacific Flyway. The language that we've worked into this bill has been agreed upon with the administration and will really provide some additional flexibility and greater opportunity to increase the acreage that participates in this program. Now, with an impending drought, we believe that these changes are absolutely necessary so that we can continue to provide the necessary habitat that we've done proudly for well over 20 years. So we ask for your aye vote. Thank you.
A number of other organizations also shared their support.
Mr. Chair and members, Mark Smith on behalf of the Grassland Water District and the Northern California Guides and Sportsmen's Association in support. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. Jamie Goh on behalf of Environmental Defense Fund in support. Thank you.
Hey, Juan Altamirano with Audubon California in support.
Chair and members, Gary Link with Northern California Water Association in support.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Gain, speaking today on behalf of the Tulare Basin's Wetlands Association, the San Diego County Wildlife Federation, the Black Brant Group, Sassoon Resource Conservation District, California Deer Association, and the CalOR Wetlands and Waterfowl Council in strong support of AB 614.
Good afternoon. Keely Hoskins with the Congressional Sportsmen's Foundation here today in support.
With no one opposed to the bill, the committee voted to move it forward. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
We've been covering the State Assembly Committee on Water, Parks, and Wildlife. They were scheduled to hear discussion on Bill AB 534, but it was postponed. We are still watching it, however. AB 534 would mean some significant changes. The bill states it would require ropeless fishing gear to be used when taking any species of fish for commercial or recreational purposes in any trap fishery. Most fishermen right now do not use ropeless gear, but the text of the bill states varieties of ropeless fishing gear are available and being tested off the west and east coasts of the United States and in Canada. It also states that some fishers already fish without the use of static vertical buoy lines. However, the bill states, logistical, technical, cost, and regulatory obstacles have hampered the widespread adoption of such gear in California fisheries. I talked last week with fisherman Dick Ogg, who joined me on the phone from his boat. Here's that conversation. I wanted to talk to you today about AB 534. And so from what I have learned, I've been doing some reading on this, and it would have big effect on California fishermen. And it would require some changes in how you do your job. So can you explain to me what kind of changes this would mean for you?
Okay, first I have to ask, I have to get clarity on what's good. Because in all reality, what we're doing by, switching to the ropeless gear or the pop-up gear, all this pop-up gear utilizes, except for one particular innovator, utilizes rope. And one of the problems that we have is the reliability of the equipment. So the alterations that would have to happen would be significant on the fisherman's side. In other words, the process in which we, operate, we're able to bring in a pot up, dump the crabs, rebait the pot, and redeploy it, and typically under a minute to a minute and 15 seconds. Given these pop-up type gear systems, we're able to see an increase between 2 to 5 minutes between pots. Now, keeping that in mind, my allocation is 350 pots. If hypothetically I could pull in one straight line and never have to stop, I would actually be able to finish all my equipment in roughly 6 hours, 5.83 hours. And that is about a minute or so per pot. If you add an additional 2 minutes onto my day, you're talking about close to 11 hours. And so that's, again, hypothetically saying I can pull in a straight line, never have to stop, and continue to operate exactly as we're operating now. So 2 minutes means 11 hours. That's a significant amount of time that's unpaid for. It doesn't change the amount of product that we catch. It doesn't change anything other than our time spent on the water. So, that in itself is a significant impact. In addition to the cost of the product, typically range from anywhere between, $300 to several thousand dollars each device. And the reliability on the devices is somewhere between 2 to 5% of the devices do not deploy on deployment and retrieval. So they don't come up. So what happens is that if you look at my normal everyday operation and within a year, let's just hypothetically say that I can pick up my gear roughly 20 different times. So 20 times 350 is 7,000 retrievals and deployments. Of those 7,000 times, I have lost one pot this year. Okay, one pot has been that I couldn't find. On the pop-up or ropeless systems, you're talking about 2 to 5% per deployment. So that would, if it was a single percent, if it was 1%, I would have potentially lost 70 pots in the year, plus the equipment that's on that pot. So what we'd be in effect doing is leaving additional debris in the water. These pots that are on the bottom are unrecoverable. The rope is all tied up inside the unit, and we can't access it. We're not able to recover that gear. It can self-deploy, which then becomes a potential navigation and entanglement hazard. And, you know, there's plastic buoys that have to be changed. Those are hard plastic, and they never go away. They'll be there forever. So environmentally, the impact would be significant in addition to the financial impact on the fishermen in general. Sorry for the long explanation, but that kind of gives you an idea.
Yeah, that's perfect. From what I read, the presented intent of this is to keep whales from getting entangled in the fishing equipment. Is that a significant problem, or how often does that happen?
That's a great question. And, you know, if one looks at let's go back to where the problem kind of originated from.
Okay.
In 2014 through 2016, there was a significant heat wave on the coastline, the West Coast, and we had habitat compression where there wasn't any krill. The hard bait, or the anchovies and herring and sardines, all moved along the shoreline. The whales themselves had no other place to feed, so they began to come in along the shoreline. In addition to that, we had a significant domoic acid impact in 2016, which delayed our season significantly. So we weren't able to start until sometime in March. I believe it's the middle of March or something like that, if I remember correctly. As a result, you know, there was, you know, an immense amount of interaction between, you know, fishermen and whales. And in 2016, that was the highest level of interaction that we've ever had. And that happened to be 22 whales that were entangled at that particular time. Since that time, though, in 2017, the confirmed commercial Dungeness crab interactions were 5. We were able to bring it down to 5. In the following year, I believe it was 7. And the following year was 6. So what the fishermen have done is they've figured out, or what we have done, I should say, we've minimized our line scope. We've all worked on that. I did quite a bit of testing in terms of the line and the way it hangs in the water. So we used to use different line leads, which made loops in the water. We don't do that anymore. And based on what we worked on through the Dungeness Crab Gear Working Group, we minimized the loops of the buoys. We went to a neutral rope, which means it doesn't float, and we can keep that line tight, and we minimize the interaction significantly. And we've also become extremely aware of how we need to fish and where we need to fish and how to reduce our potential interaction overall.
So I'm just curious, and this might be a dumb question, but I'm curious, what happens to your equipment if a whale gets entangled in it?
You know, it goes away, I'm sure. You know, I mean, normally it probably falls. The one thing I forgot to tell you, though, is, you know, and sorry, I've got to kind of revert back, you know, that the, 2017, 18, and 19, we still had minimal interaction. In 2020, we had 0 interactions within our season. And as of now, In 2021, we have no interactions at all. So, again, I want to just emphasize the fact that the fishermen have looked at the process, thought about how to improve it, and we've done a darn good job. You know, we've really been able to minimize that, you know, that interaction, that potential interaction anyway, you know. And right. Your question about what happens to the ropes and everything, sometimes they break off, sometimes they don't, sometimes they follow the animal, you know, and they're able to be disentangled. Essentially, we really don't know where they go.
But essentially, you lose the equipment and you're out the money for that equipment, too.
Correct, ma'am. Yes.
Yeah.
So it sounds like this is something that the fishermen want to prevent anyway, because it's better for your business to prevent that, too. Am I correct in assuming that, or am I off the rails?
You are right on the money. I mean, the last thing we want to do is have any potential interaction of any kind, because it not only is it, you know, not environmentally friendly, but it's also detrimental financially to us. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. We have no desire to do, you know, to interact with anything other than the targeted species. That's real important to know and understand.
I want to be really transparent for our listeners that, you know, they understand. I know you and I understand, but that they understand we're one-sided here. We're not really presenting both sides of this argument. I just am having a hard time figuring out why they thought that this legislation was actually needed, because as you pointed out, records show there is actual data that shows this has not been very much of a problem past that year when it spiked. And like you pointed out, it spiked because basically the whales' food moved inland more. So there was more of an opportunity during that time. Is that right?
Yeah, it was an anomalous year.
Yeah.
And we have the same question, Sabrina. I mean, in all honesty, we cannot figure out why, you know, something like this. And now keep in mind that this just doesn't necessarily impact just the crab or the commercial Dungeness crab fishery. It affects every single vertical line in existence. That means long lines. That means spot prawns. That means lobster. That means coon striped shrimp, slime meal. All of the fisheries that utilize vertical line, all are impacted by this particular bill. And until the devices are made reliable, where we, you know, where something, you know, number one, we need to know they're going to work all the time, and we need to be sure that it's going to be safe for my crew. You know, I don't want the guys back there struggling, trying to put things together and get tangled up in ropes and, you know, put them into a bag. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it's not ready. And we need to be sure that there's really a major problem before we begin to alter what is a very, very functional, sustainable fishery.
I read in the bill itself that it was talking about equipment that is still being tested even. I'm looking at it right now and I can't find the right paragraph, so I apologize for that. But it's talking about equipment that's still being tested. Does that bother you that they're talking about, you know, it's not even completely used yet, that they're still trying it out and they want you to switch to these types of things?
Well, here's, you know, I've tested a lot of it. And just to give you an example, two of my pots are sitting on the bottom in the sanctuary because the gear did not deploy. Now, that means that, you know, I mean, that's one time. I went out and tested it one time, and I lost two pots. So, you know, that in itself is very uncomfortable to me. The other thing that we need to consider is that this equipment, this pop-up or ropeless gear, has been around since 1998. And it was contracted, if I'm not mistaken, by NIMS and NOAA to experiment or look at the possibility of utilizing it in, you know, certain fisheries, of which it has never been able to be used appropriately. So, I mean, the equipment or the gear itself has been around for over 20 years. If it was really functional and something that would work for the fisheries in general, it would seem to me it would have already been put into place. And unfortunately, it has not. So just another aspect that needs to be considered.
That's our show for today. Our Farmer of the Week segment is starting soon. Don't forget to nominate a farmer by going to myaglife.com, click on Daily News, then in the upper right-hand corner, click Nominate a Farmer. This has been the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Crew, thanks for listening.